And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Richard. He's coming up on 4 years, come January 29th. When I make that 7:30 early morning study meeting, which is as often as I can, I live in Gainesville, Richard's there, and he contributes. And I see him around here. He's one of those guys that make getting sober happy, joyous, and free. Welcome, Richard.
My name's Richard. I am an alcoholic. And this is the first time I'm telling my story, so please help me. What it used to be like, I'm going to just start off as a child. I grew up as a fourth child of a family of four. Mom and dad never drank, but I had some friends whose family drank and would always hang out at the bar, and they seemed to be having more fun than my family did. And so I thought, well, what better place to go? I remember my first drink, and I heard here, if you may be an alcoholic, if you can remember your first drink. And as at 9 years old, I had a Red Pop at my uncle's house during Christmas time, actually. It was Slow Gin and 7-Up. And when you puke that stuff up on a white shirt with a little jacket on, it leaves a stain. But I remember that drink, and I remember most of the other ones I had. There's quite a few that I don't remember drinking. But I grew up, and back then, went through middle school, you know, elementary, middle school. When I got 15 years old, I remember we had this guy, Steve Ravenette. Everybody would get his fake ID. I would just pass it down through the neighborhood because you could drink at 18. So at 15, I thought it was a good idea to start going to the bars and hanging out in the bars. After that, played football in high school and did those types of things athletic-wise. But I started, you know, giving up some of the things so I could practice my drinking with my drinking buddies. During my senior year in high school, we really started drinking. We'd get a keg of beer on Monday nights, and we'd drink it to the end, to the keg was gone. And I remember my last football game, I was on the way to Hunting Club, and I drank a bottle of Black Velvet, and I was passed out in the back seat trying to go up to the hunting lodge, and I thought that was normal. I mean, that's what I did when I was that age. And a friend of mine, I got killed in a drunk driving accident. He killed himself in a drunk driving accident. He went over a thing, but that slowed me down for a little while. And when he's in the hospital, he lived for 3 days, and it made an impact on me that he had these two male nurses, and they said that I should go to nursing school to honor him. And so I went off to went off to college, and I started thinking about it, and ended up enrolling in nursing school. Well, I quit drinking as much. You know, I knew that I couldn't study, read, and drink all the same way that I was doing. But I went to interview to get into nursing school. They had a hospital program, and you can go, you know, as a diploma nurse. And I went there, and I interviewed with the guy, the dean of the school, and he's looking at my transcripts, and he says, Richard, he said, you had a lot of fun in high school, didn't you? And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, how can you tell? He said, it's one of those questions you should never ask. He said, because you sure the hell didn't study. I said, well, yeah. He said, but this one's really puzzling me. He said, how did you get a D- in gym class? And I said, well, I would have got an E, but I was a captain of the football team. So they let me get away with that. So I went through nursing school and didn't drink as much then. But then towards the end of nursing school, when I was about done, I started drinking again, you know, alcoholically. And I graduated before the class. I went through a two-year program in 13 months. Me and another guy that put us on the accelerated program. And so then I went back to be the escort and the usher of the class that I was supposed to graduate with. And I remember waking up in this bedroom, and there's these little stuffed animals and toy trucks. And I'm just like, oh, man, how the hell did I end up here? And there I was, you know, just as drunk as could be, and not knowing how I got there. But, you know, they just laughed about it, and it's, you know, no real consequences. And then one thing you should never do, you should never get thrown into the same jail that you work in. I've come up, well, it kind of worked out for me. So I was up in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. I didn't tell you that. But we're going to the beaches there, or like going to Lake Lanier. And we ran out of, we'd drink these things called ORVs, off-road vodkas, and we'd get a Coleman pool or fill it full of vodka and put a bunch of fruit in it. Well, we ran out of that, and me and this other guy thought it was a good idea to go get some more beer. And I got pulled over doing 100 miles an hour with a cold beer between my legs. And I never thought I'd ever get into that situation where you couldn't say your ABCs. And I did. I couldn't say them. And I remember the policeman, I kept on telling him, if you ever get shot, I might be taking care of you. I'm sure that made him feel better. But he didn't throw me in jail for DUI. It's like, wow. He made me follow him. I blew a .26. And he said, you got to follow me to the next county line, and they're going to take you to jail for, you know, outstanding ticket. And that's the jail that I worked part-time in. I'd go out and pass out medicines to the inmates and things like that. But when I got there, the thing I remember is that they asked me if I was going to blow, and I said, no blow for me, no blow for me. And they put me in a private cell because I was worked there. I guess, you know, there's a benefit of I didn't have to go in the drunk tank. And I woke up with the biggest gob of saliva on the side of my face, stuck to the cement bed. And that didn't slow me down. I kept on drinking. And fast forward, you know, how did I get here? You know, I asked myself that many times. Drugs are a part of my story as well, and that's really what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew as a drug addict, I knew, you know, things that I did at work. I got caught diverting medications from a Pyxis system at the hospital. And I tried and tried and tried to quit doing that, and I'd go through withdrawals. I'd go back to the hospital, and I wouldn't be there but 30 minutes, and I'd be, you know, I'd be in the Pyxis stealing drugs and being in the bathroom going, God, how did I end up here? You know, what am I doing? And then, you know, that ease and comfort would come after I, you know, injected it. And the guilt and, you know, just the shame of doing that. And then, you know, I just said, you know, I can't quit. So I tried going, you know, to a clinic, and, you know, they give you medication so you don't go through withdrawals. And then I switched jobs because they said that the records that they kept didn't match up with the records that they should have been keeping. And so that went on for about 3 years. I switched jobs and job jump. And then I got a call, and there was a guy who wanted to talk to me. He had the wrong address. He was from the Attorney General's office, and he had some paperwork for me. And so I had to go outside and wait for him to pull up. You know, I didn't knock on the door. I had to go out and meet him. And I remember thinking, he handed me these papers I had to sign for him, and I remember thinking, the lie is finally over. You know, this, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that this lie, you know, has finally been able to stop. And then I did, you know, I stopped, and I have to get an evaluation for my alcohol and drug use and things. So I go to the addictionologist, and like any good medical professional knows that, you know, whenever somebody tells you about their alcohol use, you always double it. So I cut mine in a quarter, and because I knew he was going to double it. And so I tell this guy, I drank a 12-pack of beer on the weekends and maybe like a half a pint of peppermint schnapps. Well, I haven't drank peppermint schnapps since I lived in Michigan. I was Jägermeister, you know, right out and told things and early in the morning and all that kind of stuff. But and then one of the other, I could time going to the bar so well that I actually met the bartender unlocking the door as I was reaching for it. You know, on Saturday mornings, they open up at 11 o'clock and they could make it to the Highlander where they're unlocking it. Or they'd let me in the back door if I got there too early. And on Sundays, they'd let me in, and then they wouldn't start ringing up the tab until after 12 o'clock because you can't start selling alcohol till noon on Sundays. And then I got one of the as it got towards the end, my drinking really, when I got thrown in jail for not paying child support, and I didn't go into DTs. I thought, well, I ain't no alcoholic. I mean, I didn't shake. I didn't have no seizures or anything, so I'll be all right. And I stayed in there for 13 days, 16 hours, and 27 minutes for not paying child support. But that was her fault. You know, she shouldn't have been charging so much. I mean, I was doing the best I could. So I got out of jail, and that's when my drinking really took off. I was able to quit taking drugs out of the pictures. I changed jobs and went to Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and they just give little doses. I mean, it took me a year to save up enough to get anything like that. So I figured alcohol was, you know, it's safer. You know, I'm not an alcoholic because I didn't go into DTs. So one day I was at the Highlander. This is my favorite bar that I'd go to. And I was sitting at the bar and drinking all day. My wife was at work, and I had the perfect wife. She'd come pick me up from the bar. And I said that once in a meeting, and a guy said he's going to tell that to my wife and next time he saw her. But she'd come pick me up, and when she came, and the paranoia started to take effect. You know, when everybody's out to get you, and or you don't even know if they are or not. But I'd made a phone call to a friend. And when I did, another guy answered it, and he told me the collard greens are ready. And that's, we used to say collard greens for a slang for stuff that you'd smoke. And I was like, collard greens? You know, how'd that happen? I mean, they're out to get me. So my wife came, and I said, we got to get out of here right now, because a new guy sat down next to me at the bar, and I didn't know him, and he was undercover cop, you know. So he's on to me. And so I mean, this is so crazy when you say it out loud. And so I had her take me home all these back ways, and there's a white SUV. The cops are in the white SUV, and I'd have her pull into a driveway, back out, go down this way, turn around, go back around. You know how many white SUVs are in Atlanta? There's quite a few. Came down Cliff Valley Way, and we're sitting at the red light, and there's a white SUV dropping off books at the library. And it's like, you're in on it. I knew you were in on it. He's like, just shut up, you drunk. Just let me get you home so you can pass out. We pull into the driveway, and she says, and finally make it to the door, and she hears a helicopter coming. We're in the flight path, the Children's, and she's like, oh my God, if he hears that helicopter, I'm never going to get him in the house. He's just going to, he's going to know it's them after him. So, you know, like any good alcoholic, we go back to the scene of the crime. So we go back to the Highlander the next day, and my friend Abraham comes in and says, Richard, what happened to you last night? I called you and told you the collard greens are ready that you wanted me to cook for you. It's like, oh, that's what the collard green story is all about. There's actually collard greens that he's cooking. Whew. So then I got here. I made an appointment with my friend Karen to take me to an AA meeting because, you know, after the addictionologist, you know, put it all together and said, well, you might need to go to that AA. You know, you might be an alcoholic, you know, because he probably did the math according to my calculations as well. So I called her up, and she said, well, meet me Saturday morning at the Gwinnett Room. So I drove up there and met her, and just nervous, you know, felt like crap. But my last drink, I remember my first drink, and I remember my last drink. I went out to dinner with my father-in-law, and I had one margarita. It's like, man, it's my last drink. But the thing I remember about it is that we had a pitcher of margaritas. I had one because I was driving. I knew that, and my wife wanted me to drive, so I was going to AA the next morning anyways. You know, can't go there with a hangover, so I had to be respectful. So he drank, we drank, I drank one, and he drank the rest of them. But he had that empty glass, you know, when you're trying to get that next one, and he's like licking the inside of that empty glass trying to get that last drop. And I knew what that was about. And I remember, and I've since been, you know, I've learned in here that's part of the craving that we have, that we can't let go of it until we get a, you know, spiritual solution. So I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first week I felt like crap. There's some guys that would come around and talk to new people, and I you know, my perception of reality is so skewed. I said, well, how did you know I was a new guy? He said, because you look like shit. I said, oh. But he asked me one thing. He said, do you pray? And I always lied. I'd, you know, make the grandiose, you know, thing that I was, you know, and it went through my head that I was a deacon of a church. I have a pew. I did buy a pew that when I was married to my first wife. I bought a pew up in Gwinnett so I could have a front row seat at the church. And, you know, that thought that would help me out. But what I told him, I said no. He asked me if I prayed, and I said no. And it was the first time that I was honest with a stranger, you know, that I didn't try to exaggerate and expand on, you know, my greatness. But then I, you know, came to Navitz, just a mile and a half away, and I'm amazed at how close AA meetings are to where I used to drink. And I mean, I used to drink everywhere, so, you know, pretty, you know, there's probably going to be one close by. But I got here, and I went back to that next Saturday. I went back to that meeting, and everybody said the newcomer's the most important person at an AA meeting, and I was okay with that. I figured, you know, I knew that. I thought it was pretty important. So if you, you know, I could agree with you on that. But I went back, and they, you know, how they have you at, is there anything, any burning desires that might make you drink, or anything on your mind that you want to talk about? So being the nice, arrogant person I am, I raised my hand, and I said, yeah, this thing, honesty, I don't know nothing about that. And that guy looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, everybody knows about honesty. But I didn't, you know, I didn't know how to be honest. I drank so much that, you know, I didn't know what honesty was. You know, I kind of, you know, I wouldn't steal too much from you. Sometimes, Bill, I took a little bit, but, you know, I'm going to give it back to you later. But, you know, I just didn't know what it was. And I started feeling better, and I wanted to know more about honesty. I got a home group pretty quick, and meetings at NAVOD, I got to the 7:30 meeting at 8 o'clock because who would start at the meeting at on the half hour? You know, most meetings start on the hour. And then that 5:45 meeting, that really threw me off. I mean, why would you start a meeting at 5:45? I mean, but those are two of the meetings that I really like going to. And the 7:30 early morning study group is my home group. And I really liked that literature base because I got to learn a lot about alcoholism. And that part about, you know, we have an allergy. And I could relate to an allergy with medications and how it affects different people. I used to work in the burn unit at Grady, and we get patients then that would take medicines that other people could take. But if you had an allergy to this particular medicine, your skin would peel off. And so I could relate to that. I could relate how one person could drink and they'd do fine, and the other person would drink and it would turn out like the situations that I turned into, you know, the blackouts and not being able to, you know, not be able to control it. And I never started out drinking to end up passed out in my wife's shoe closet, but I ended up there. And, you know, and I just couldn't figure out how I ended up there. Well, I got sentenced to 2 years of probation by the State Board of Nursing. And for a while there, I thought about changing careers. You know how it says we'll change our goals to meet our drinking? And I thought I would go and I could go and cut grass at a golf course. That'd be a good job for me. You know, you could, you know, ride around on a lawnmower and cut grass. I thought that made sense to me. But, you know, calmer heads prevailed, and they said that I had 2 years of probation, and I thought, well, I can do this for 2 years. I mean, I can not drink for 2 years. I should be able to do that. But when I got here, you said I didn't have to stop drinking for 2 years. All I had to do was stop drinking today. And I thought, wow, I can stop drinking today. And that was January 26th of 2008. And today I didn't take a drink, and I don't think I'll have to take a drink tomorrow. Step two, when the God thing, you know, when I got here, God and I, well, back up to step one, I was doing fine, you know, a couple months, I was feeling good, you know, the jitters, the headaches, night sweats, they all went away, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic, maybe, you know, maybe I just drank too much, you know. Well, it was about March or April, it got cold again, and I'd work for a part-time job I have. I work on an ambulance, and I had these winter coats. But it got cold enough to put that coat back on, And I reached in and I pulled out my goals for the year. And the first one was I'd only drink 3 days a week. And it's like I conceded to my innermost self that if that's my first goal, I work 4 days a week. So I figured I wouldn't have to drink those days. I could make it to the other 3 days. But that's when I knew that if I'm going to have a goal like that, to, you know, non-alcoholics, they don't make goals. I don't think they make goals like that. I don't know. I didn't. But that's when I conceded to my innermost self that I'm not going to have to, you know, that I am an alcoholic. When I got here, I was a little confused as to what I was. You know, if a lady yelled at somebody for talking about drugs at the AA meeting, and I said, golly, I'm not going to be able to, I can't fit in there. But then I talked to a guy after the 7:30 meeting, and, you know, I was all crazy-eyed, and I'd probably been here a week or two, and he says, well, what's your problem? And I said, I don't know. I said, what's yours? He says, well, I'm tri-addicted. And I heard of dual addiction, dual diagnosis. I said, what's tri-addicted? He said, I tried it and I was addicted. And I said, yeah, that's what I am. So I stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous, and God and I really, you know, working in the burn unit, and you see things as a nurse that, and you know, in the medical field that happen, and you just say, how, you know, God, why did you let that happen? I said, what, you know, when that little girl, you know, that blew up, that was 5 years old, you know, why didn't you blow the match up before, you know, before it ignited and burned her up? You know, why didn't you stop that crackhead from putting that claw hammer through that little boy's head? And, you know, so God and I really didn't like, if I was God, you know, if I had his power, I wouldn't be acting like that. It was what I thought. And I said, how can there be a God that would let things like that happen? But then, my home group talks, a couple of the old timers over talk about putting God's inventory over here and yours over here, and you just take care of this side and let God take care of that side, and you just keep on coming back. I said, all right, well, I got to be here for 2 years anyway, so I'll keep on coming back. So, but I came back long enough to realize what, you know, what Alcoholics Anonymous can give to somebody. And then I said, all right, somebody will restore me to sanity, because I didn't think I was insane. But then it was pointed out to me that, you know, most non-insane people don't start off the, you know, after getting paid, you don't end up with a negative $500 balance in your checking account because you spent the money. Wachovia used to let you get $500 out, you know, before you got your paycheck if you had direct deposit, and they even quit doing that though. So that was pointed out to me that, you know, most normal people wait till the money gets there before they start drawing it out. And then, you know, so that, okay, I'm, you know, maybe I'm a little bit crazy. And then step three, I had to make a decision to turn my power. Well, when I started looking at two and three, it's like, man, if I do two and three, that means I'm going to have to do step four. And if I do step four, you know, there's some things I don't want to tell anybody. I mean, I don't want to know any of that stuff. I wasn't going to tell anybody some of that stuff that I'd done. It was just, you know, it's okay, you know, I'm just going to take that to my grave. And I don't want to revisit the past. But I finally accepted that, you know, maybe if I turn my, you know, to God of my understanding, it's going to be okay. And about that time around step three, I had the opportunity to go to San Francisco for a conference. And I got up early to go to an early meeting. I like the early meetings. And I go down to Fisherman's Wharf, and it's on Green Street. Well, it's like 798 Green Street. When I get down there, there's like 795, and then there's this mountain. And it's like, well, where's 798? I mean, it's got to be close. I mean, if there's 785 or whatever it was. And there's this guy out waxing his car at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I ask him, I said, where's this address? He said, well, you got a car? I said, no. He said, well, you can take those steps right over there. And it's just over that hill. Well, I wasn't in the best of shape, but I thought, I guess this is the part where we're willing to go to any length to maintain your sobriety. So I started up these steps, and I did it 12 at a time. I'd count 1 through 12 and start all over. And as it did, I started walking up there, and one of the people, I went to a nurses group as part of my probationary and consent order from the State Board of Nursing, and this girl told me, she goes, "Yeah, Richard, you know, flowers are going to smell better." And I'm looking at it, "Yeah, right, the flowers are going to smell better when you quit drinking." And she was right. So I started walking up these steps, and I started, you know, I quit thinking about the, you know, how painful it's going to be. I just focused on these 12 steps, and I started smelling the gardens from this little path that I was walking up. Well, I went from Fisherman's Wharf up to Detroit Tower, and it just stayed focused on the steps. And I got to the top, and there's these two people out there talking, and I asked them where this, you know, 798 Green Street was, and they said, "See that second hill over there? It's over there." And it's like, oh God, I guess this is the part where, you know, maybe you and God may be the only person there for a meeting. And it was, I turned around, and on, to my left was the Golden Gate Bridge, and to my right was Alcatraz. And it's the most beautiful sight I'd seen, and it was so vibrant. And I just thought, these are the promises. If you take the steps, good things are going to happen. And so I went ahead and went to step four. And step four, I always have to laugh. I asked about 10 guys here, how do you do step four? How do you do it? So you just do it, Richard. I thought, how do you do it? And after I did it, I realized they didn't hear what I was asking. I said, not how to do it, but when are you going to do it for me? Because that's the pattern of my life. You know, I had two older sisters, and they would do anything and everything for me. I used everybody that I came in contact with. As one selfish individual, if I gave you something, I expected two things in return. And that's what I was asking, for somebody else to take that step for me. So I did it, and I saw those patterns, those character defects. You know, where was I selfish, and the resentments I had. One of them was against my parents. You know, I moved from Michigan, and they wouldn't come down to visit. And one time they came, when I was married to my ex-wife, they came to visit, and I borrowed their truck and went out with a friend and came back, I'm not sure when, around 11 or 12 at night, left them there with my ex-wife and my two daughters. And just came back. I don't know what I said to them that night, but I know they left the next morning, because I was in a blackout driving their vehicle. And I'd been doing that for years, you know, to my parents and to other people, just using their stuff up and using their trust. And then, so I did step four, went over it with my sponsor. I got a sponsor right away. A gentleman introduced me to another person in the medical field, and like I said, I'm here for 2 years. I might as well go ahead and, you know, get the sponsor too. And he said, "Why don't you do step five? You know, do it with God first, and then, you know, then if you want to do it with me, that's fine." So he said, "Why don't you find a spiritual place?" I did it on Mother's Day. My mother had passed away the year before, and she taught me how. She came out of dialysis and went to hospice, and I went up there to take care of her. And the first night she came back from the nursing home to go into hospice, and she decided to stop taking dialysis. She called me into it's about 3 o'clock in the morning. I hear, "Richard, Richard," and it scared me. So I went in there and I said, "Yeah, Mom." She goes, "Tell me a joke." And I said, "Tell you a joke?" And then say, "Man, you know, put me on the spot." So I told her a joke about, and it's kind of funny too, but I told her a joke about going to heaven. When you get to the pearly gates, you know, Peter comes by and he's going to take you on a tour of heaven. So, you know, over here are the Baptists are yelling and screaming heaven, you know, hell and brimfire, and Catholics over here drinking, having a good time. And he said, "No." And then they duck down and go past this other door. And, she, you know, "Who's in there?" And he said, "That's the Jehovah's Witnesses. They think they're the only ones here." So I told her that joke. And but I drank during that, you know, those years of invisibility when you think nobody knows you're drinking. I'd go get her medications from the pharmacy or go get her supplies, and I'd get me a pint of vodka and come back and, you know, drink it down in the bedroom and thinking that I wasn't an alcoholic. But she taught me how to, you know, pass away with dignity. Her friends, we got her up for the first, first week she was there. She'd get up into her favorite rocking chair. All her friends would come by and say goodbye to her. She, you know, her preacher would come by. And so I thought I'd do it on Mother's Day. My wife had left. I'd do my fifth step on Mother's Day. My wife had left to go see her mother. And I was out out in the parking lot at Napa. It was the most spiritual place that I knew of. And I remember, you know, reading over my four step and taking my fifth step with God, and praying and just crying, and tears running down my eyes. And a friend of mine pulled up and said, "What's going on?" I told him. He said, "Now go home, you know, just relax." And I went home and sat on the back porch. And it was a real windy day. And the pine trees, you know, we had those tall pines, and they were just blowing, you know, back and forth. And it looked like a symphony of pine trees. And it was such a moving experience for me. And I didn't know what had happened, but I knew that my life had been changed. I didn't know where it was going to take me or what it had done, but I knew it was going to change. And boy, has it changed. The way it's changed some of the things that have happened. I still work at Children's, and one of the opportunities I get to volunteer at a kids' camp, Camp Braveheart, it's called. And they let me go there for a week during the summer. And this summer, I got an opportunity to see a little girl that had a stroke. And she was going up this rope swing to go down a zip line, and her friends were there, and she was struggling to get up there because she only had strength in one side of her body, and she's pulling up with one arm and they pull on the ropes, and the friends were there going, "We love you, you can do it. And that's what I think of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody here is pulling each other to get us up that ladder, get us up those steps. And if I would have kept on drinking, I would have never saw that. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got an opportunity to see something like that. So then, you know, I did step five with the rest of it with my sponsor, and that was fine. And I always think of a sponsor as somebody that you can practice being honest with, you know, so you can take it out to other people in the rest of your affairs. And step six, you know, I realized that I had some character defects, even me. And, you know, one of them is being selfish. And so, what are you going to do when you're selfish? You're supposed to help somebody else. So my wife is cooking Thanksgiving dinner, and she has all these dishes just going crazy. I mean, flowers everywhere. It's like, "Are you having fun, honey?" She goes, "Yeah, I am, but you know, I'm trying to figure out a way I can help her." She goes, "But I really don't like doing the dishes." It's like, well, I guess that's the part where I can help her do the dishes. So I started doing that. And I always say my wife is a good barometer as to where my sobriety is. The first year chip that I got, we got in a fight before I left. The second year chip, she gave it to me. And then my third year chip, she kissed me and said, "Have a good day." So I think that's trying to get back to the middle of the road a little bit. So I got to step six and seven and asked them to remove my, you know, defects of character. And an example of that is I had the opportunity, my wife always wanted me to come sit in the bathroom with her. And I've shared, if you've been at the 7:30 meeting, I've shared this there before. It's like, who is, you know, what man in their right mind wants to go sit in the bathroom while their wife's taking a bath? I mean, there's ESPN, top 10 plays of the day. You know, who wants to do that? It's like, oh, God, I guess this is the part about being selfish. You might as well go in there and do it. So I go in there and sit down, and she got the biggest smile on her face, just that heartwarming, "Wow, you actually did something for me," where she validated that. You know, that love that you get when somebody does it. And I thought, God, what a selfish SOB. I've been depriving myself of that inner peace by seeing that smile for 8 years because I was too busy, to, you know, whatever, doing something for myself instead. And that's the amazing thing I found about Alcoholics Anonymous is that when you do give something away, you get so much back. It's not the material things, it's the inner peace things. And then step eight, I made a list of all the people I'd harmed, and then went over that with my sponsor. And step nine, I started making amends. And my first one was to my father. He wasn't doing real well, and he was getting sick, and I really needed to do it for myself. And so I went up to Michigan and talked to him, and he told me that my life was he is so disappointed in me that my life had become such a disappointment. But you know, the difference that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, and I talked, and I knew it wasn't going to go well. He just wasn't a, you know, happy, huggy kind of guy. You know, he's going to be honest. And But the difference was, I said, yeah, but Dad, yeah, but I didn't say, yeah, but Dad. I just stood there and said, thank you. And because, you know, I brought it to my sponsor before I went to make the amends. And then the other day, I got to make my latest amends with my buddy Bill. He said, well, you never said you're sorry to me. So I just said, I'm sorry. And he said, you're sorry. So that was my latest amends. But, you know, the biggest, and like I said, I always know, you know, when I start to pat myself on the back, I was, this summer, I was in the kitchen with my wife, and I was telling her, can you believe it's been over 3 years since I had a drink? She goes, you know, I was just thinking about that, cutting up this tomato. She goes, do you remember that time where you yelled at me and screamed at me because I cut the tomato wrong? I was like, wow. I really need some more work to do. So I think I'll go back to that meeting over there where they, you know, where I don't have to come anymore. I get to come, and I want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and see what the next promise is going to be. And then I got to step 10, and I think about, I was at work, and we have where the children's, where their beds, they have TVs up over the top, and I have this assistant nurse manager that got a job that I, you know, they should have gave me. And but you know, it's amazing. I didn't interview for it. I didn't apply for it. But yeah, they should have gave it to me. But she's talking to me, and I'm just staring up at these TVs. You know, just the little kid that I am. You know, just the little spoiled brat that I am. And she's just talking, and I'm staring, you know, staring up there. And it's like, and she leaves and goes to the bathroom. Like, oh, man, this must be step 10. I guess I got to make an amends to her. So I wait for her to get out of the bathroom. And I said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry I was so disrespectful. And she goes, well, thanks for apologizing. Do you feel like talking now? And I said, yeah. And so we sat down and had an adult conversation about something that I could do. I don't even know what it was. But it was important at the time. And then I got to step 11. And I try to, you know, try to improve my conscious contact with God. And I have the opportunity to fly on an air ambulance. And we went up to Kalamazoo, Michigan. And the pilot turned around. We're about 50 miles outside of Kalamazoo. And he turned around and he said, we're going to have to make an emergency landing. It's like, emergency? And I wondered what that flashing red light meant. But now I know. If you see, look up there at the cockpit and there's a flashing red light, it's not a good thing. He said that he had to turn off one of the engines that the oil pressure kept on dropping. And it's like, man, this may be the day. But it was different. I didn't say, please land this plane. I mean, please get me down there. You know, and I'll jump out and everything will be fine. The prayer was different, and I learned it from one of the chaplains at work. She prayed. It's really weird when you are praying for somebody to get a heart for a heart transplant, you know, because something bad has to happen to somebody else. And how do you ask God for that? But she said, the prayer was, when she was saying it with the family, she thanked the other family for having the courage and the willingness that God had gave them to make that decision going through a difficult time and realizing that God was in their life, that for them to make a decision to donate the heart and donate life. So that day, I'm flying in, and you get to see, it's right, just like TV, they got the big old ambulances out there and fire trucks and everything. But the prayer I said is like, I said, you know, higher power, please talk to my children's higher power, my wife's higher power, my friend's higher power, and let them know that I loved them, if this is the day. And to get that inner peace, I mean, it was so weird. It was, you know, better than any drug I'd ever done, better than any drink I'd ever drank. And to know that it was going to be okay, whatever happened was going to be okay, I totally, totally had turned it over to my higher power and whatever decision. But then we landed, it's like, man, couldn't we get stuck in Jamaica or someplace instead of Kalamazoo, Michigan in January? But, you know, that's what happens. I've still got work to do. So then, step 12, working with others and trying to practice these principles in all our affairs. I told you that the Attorney General got me here through the recommendations and threats or whatever you want to call it. And But I didn't tell you the part about this lady that also helped me. She called me. She's a nurse. It's called a nurse advocate. And when you get in trouble with the nursing board, they assign you to this aftercare group, and you're supposed to go there, and they get to monitor your drug tests, and you have to meet once a week. Well, she called me from her, she just had back surgery. And that just, she called me from her hospital bed and said, you know, that it's going to be okay. This is the phone number I want you to call. A lady's in the program, and she'll help you out, you know, and it's going to be okay. And I thought, okay, I'll try that. Well, today I'm a nurse advocate. I have a group at Peachford Hospital. And I like to whine a little bit, but I'm clearing up the wreckage of somebody else's past, somebody that had relapsed and really left about 15 nurses in a bind without sending in their quarterly reports. And so last Tuesday and Wednesday, I was on the phone and emailing the State Board of Nursing, and Wednesday morning I got a call from the Attorney General's office. And Janet Jackson is the lady's name. She said, Richard, I need your help with some of these nurses. And, you know, they don't have any reports from the other lady that used to run your group. And I need these reports before we can release them. Well, there's about four nurses that are done with their consent orders and they're off probation. So I thought, wow. There I am whining about, why am I doing this? Why am I stuck on the phone with Janet Jackson talking to the State Board of Nursing? Why am I doing this? And I realized why I'm doing it, so I can stay sober and get those promises. But to have Janet Jackson call me and ask me for help, you know, where else is this program going to take me, and where can it take you? You know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, sometimes the first honest moment, at least my life, was admitting that I didn't know anything about honesty. So I could really relate to your story. Rachel's going to come up and give out the chips. They're all laid out right here for you, Rachel.
I'm Rachel, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, y'all. In this program, we have a chip system, starting off with a white chip, just for today. Let me give it up. Anybody want to pick up a white chip tonight? Got any more? We have a silver chip after 30 days and nights of continuous sobriety. Does anybody need to pick up a silver chip? 3 months is the red chip. 6 months is the yellow chip. 9 months is green. And for a year or multiples thereof, we have the blue chip. Anybody have a birthday tonight? And we'll offer the white chip one more time. Any reconsiderations? It's up here if you want to come and get it. Thank God for the chips you hold.
Great job, Rachel. Okay, so now we've come to, and we have time, for AA and NAVA Club related announcements.
Okay.
Hey, Brian.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm probably sober up now.
Yes, indeed.
I'll
see
the
literature
cabinet. I'll be in the cabinet after
the meeting. See Brian for literature. Hey, Frank.
I'm Frank Brian. I'm a sober alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
On December 10th, the Atlanta Biscayne Room is having a trim the Biscayne Room party. They're going to decorate the building. Their very own merchandiser is going to be Santa Claus. So if you want to go over there and have some of Russ's rap and have all your dreams come true,
that's your chance.
December 17th, NAVA is having a kids' Christmas. where you bring your kids downstairs and Santa Claus is down there. They'll make cookies and ornaments and make a mess of the building downstairs and have fun. And Santa will get the presents. And they're also having a secret Santa for people that can't afford gifts for their own kids. They'll pick out four or five needy people and they'll buy gifts for them. They'll take donations for that.
So we're taking donations in advance or that day?
Yeah, you see Debbie O or some of her little elves. Rachel might be one of those.
Rachel's one? Outstanding. And next week we've got Alan Siegel coming back, and I tell you, he'll make sobriety fun. Last time I saw him, I fell out of a chair laughing. He's hilarious. Not quite as funny as Richard. Richard had some good ones tonight. The week after, we've got some invitations out, but we haven't confirmed on the 19th. But on the 26th, the day after Christmas, Nava's Santa Claus is going to tell a story. And that's Kurt Meyer. And, okay, go ahead.
I've got one other announcement. Nava has a reading program for people that don't read well or can't read. And there's a list of people that are willing to get prior instruction and help you with that. If you've got 15 people or 20 people ready and willing to help, just put your name and phone number or somewhere to contact you in the NAVA door slot, and you will be contacted.
Okay. Yes, that's a good thing. Reading tutor available through NAVA. Okay. But anything else? There are no further announcements. I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
Can you read this out? Right.
Who woke us up this morning? Our God, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back for the works that you work with.
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. For a heart that beats for me, takes me where the promises are in. And I always long something to set me free. Promises are real.